Or we could do it on the dark web.
Yeah. That's where you go to buy, you know, gums and credit card numbers.
That's
and
right.
Things, you know.
I have to say, Tim, you sounded a real expert on the dark web.
That's where he goes for all his illicit substances.
Yeah.
Or
we are recording this bit, aren't we, John?
Yeah, that's right. All right, shall we kick off then if we're all ready and recording, gents?
What, actually record this week's podcast, you mean?
Well,
shall we do that?
We have to eventually, don't we?
Shall we do it? Hello and welcome to Very Knit.
Sorry.
Oh, he hasn't done it this series yet.
Let me just check on recording because I'm paranoid about this. Right, into the dark web we go.
Are you ready, Tim? Into the spooky dark web. Here we go then, as you say.
This isn't the BBC Light program.
The Tony Hancock Appreciation Society presents Ooh, Very Nearly an Armful, a Tony Hancock podcast.
Hello and welcome to Very Nearly an Armful, brought to you by the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society.
On the podcast, we'll be discussing Tony's famous series, Hancock's Half Hour.
We'll discuss the show, its production, and what we liked about it.
We rate and review the episode and just generally get our geek on about vintage comedy.
We're your hosts. I'm James.
I'm Martin.
I'm John.
And I'm Tim.
And we're spread across the south of the UK in a line from Wiltshire to Essex via Kent.
And our members are spread all over the world. We have members in Sligo, Zurich, Nashville, and a member who is able to look out of the window and confirm that it are not raining here in Tokyo.
Brilliant.
Unlike here in moist England. And in this podcast, we'll be discussing The New Nose from the fourth TV series. This was recorded on Tuesday, the 23rd of December, 1958, and then broadcast on the 16th of January, 1959. This is the only TV episode which is edited on the DVD releases, having been a transfer of the 1980s edited version overseen by Galton and Simpson.
But first of all, how's everyone doing?
Very well, thank you, James.
Yes, all good, thank you.
Yep.
I have, as promised on the last podcast, I listened to one episode of Reincarnathan, and it was well worth a listen. So as a recommendation from me to all our listeners, Reincarnathan, which is currently being repeated on Radio 4, and all the episodes are on BBC Sounds. It was a great fun episode called Space Hamster.
Space Hamster, that's intriguing, isn't it?
So it was, yes, it was very, very good.
Picture the scene. A ginormous out-of-town pet store, kind of like a smelly aircraft hangar. And there, a mile and a half up aisle 39, way beyond the bonnies and past the lizard food, a small neglected cage sits under a blinking neon bulb. And inside, Nathan looks up through the bars at a sign that reads, Bargain Bin. All hamsters must go.
This is no life, Jenny. I thought you said the panel had something exciting lined up for me.
Patience, Nathan. Your time will come. And while you wait, there's lots of fun things to do. There's the wheel, the tiny swing set, the transparent tubes, the, No, that's it.
Oh, it's like living in the gym. But there's no Sky News and everyone's a hamster. Here comes one now.
And at the other end of the spectrum, I decided to have a dip into the society's archives and listen to a few extracts from Happy-Go-Lucky that we have in our library, which are recordings made by Derek Roy. Sadly, none of the Tony Hancock elements from Happy-Go-Lucky, the Eager Beaver sketch, none of that was survives. But interestingly, the little clip that I was listening to today actually had the end credits on, which has got the list of all the characters or all the stars who appeared in the Eager Beaver sketch, which was rather nice to hear.
I remember him in Variety Bandbox when you had to fire off rockets to
Why,
get the audience to listen to it.
Philip Slessor, I can hardly believe my eyes.
Why, Derek Roy, I can hardly believe my nose. No, it's that strong hair oil of yours.
Oh.
What a very strong perfume it has.
Why, Philip, the scent of this hair oil draws the girls to me like a magnet.
Really?
Yes, it's so compelling that when I got out of my bath this morning, my bathrobe walked over and put its arms around me.
You've just heard Derek Roy in a recording of Happy-Go-Lucky, with Doreen Harris, Peggy Cochran, Harry Noble and Francis King, the Sam Brown Singers and the Augmented Dance Orchestra conducted by Stanley Black. The three eager beavers were Graham Stark, Peter Butterworth and Tony Hancock.
Yes, because I think didn't Roy record those on a sort of an early form of sort of record your own vinyl type of thing? They were on disc, weren't they? Sort of like a wax disc or something like that, I think.
I think they were some sort of acetate or wax disc that were recorded, and it was only Derek Roy only recorded elements of the show that he was in. Nothing else survives.
Awesome. Well, I've been watching a bit more Sykes because one of our listeners, Mark McGuigan, sent me the rest of the series of Sykes. So I've gradually been getting through that. And the other night I was watching one and saw young Annie Leake appear on there, who's the widow of Roger Hancock.
Well, your Clara's coming out of her shell now, Ellie.
Oh, yes. She used to be very shy and reserved, you know.
Oh, yes, I wouldn't have noticed it. Oh.
Yeah, she wouldn't say boo to a goose.
There's not a lot of people do.
I'll tell you something, you know. Today she wished me a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Oh. I didn't hear her do that.
No, well, she took me down to the bottom of the yard to tell me.
Interestingly, IMDb says she died in 2006, but I'm fairly sure that Lucy Hancock went, oh, yeah, no, Nan's still alive. She's, you know, 90-something and still going strong for her age, which was nice.
Yeah, I was trying to work that out as well, because my understanding was that she was still alive, but as you say, websites appear to say that she passed away.
No, well, the IMDb is known for being full of errors, so it's not entirely a surprise. It's like one of those things of obituaries that are published for people, and they kind of like, I'm not dead, you know. It's happened to many a celebrity over the decades, I'm sure. And the only other thing I've been watching recently is a series on the iPlayer called What We Do in the Shadows, which is a vampire flat share kind of comedy, which pokes great fun at just sort of all sorts of vampire films and things. And I quite like all those old creepy movies. So the sort of modern flat share comedy kind of thing. But it's got the him of booming voice.
Matt Berry.
Matt Berry, that's it. Playing a wonderfully theatrical character, as he always does. And written by, or created by Taika Waititi. And interestingly, the writers of Peep Show are creative consultants or executives or something on it, aren't they? Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong. So that's been quite an enjoyable thing. And I've got up to date now, so now I've got to wait for them to make the final series.
Oh, wow. Look at you. That is the baby Colin Robinson, I assume.
I can mold this boy into the most interesting adult there has ever been.
He really loves musical theatre.
What have the Dark Lord wrought?
Father!
This is the big opening of our nightclub.
We want the drinks to be very expensive, so then we attract rich humans. Rich humans are basically like veal. Conceptually repulsive, but so buttery on my tongue.
My search for a new wife has not been going so great.
I am not a creep. I am just a very ancient warrior who wishes to marry you.
Come back!
Whoops.
Cheers!
It's absolutely fantastic, that show. Matt Berry's such a talented comedian and actor. He was in, have you seen, I don't know if you guys have watched Toast of London.
I've seen a bit of Toast of London, I've heard of it.
No. Yeah. I think it's coming back onto, I want to say, oh, it's going to be on Sky soon. It was on Netflix. I'm sure you can find it on iPlayer or something. It's a bit of it's sort of ridiculous comedy, I guess. I think you'd probably frame it as, but it's very, very funny once you get into it.
Hello, Stephen. This is Clem Fandango. Can you hear me?
Here we go.
Stephen?
Who the hell are you again?
I'm Stephen Toast.
No! No, no, no!
Why does he think I'm a waiter?
A lot of people have remarked on it. It's the tash.
I hate everything about your advert.
What kind of asshole doesn't like my adverts?
When things were a little lax for John Nettles, he turned to a sport of poaching.
Poaching?
How many rabbits?
Three. That's not a rabbit, looks more like a squirrel.
It's a rabbit.
I can't think of a single person on this earth that I have any respect for.
He plays a sort of a Shakespearean sort of actor who's very much up himself, kind of pompous ass, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah, quite a failing actor with
ideas of grandeur. Not unlike Tony, I suppose, really. A similar sort of type of character.
But mainly does voiceovers. get stuck doing the voiceovers. But yeah, he seems to be ageless as well. You know, he's portraying a sort of 45-year-old man, but then he goes, I remember when I started, and it's sort of 45 years ago, and he's exactly the same age, looks exactly the same. So yeah, it's a really good watch if you get a chance to watch Toast of London, and indeed What We Do in the Shadows as well, which is brilliant.
Oh, they sound brilliant. That sounds like they're well worth a watch. Thinking of older films, one thing I did see on Talking Pictures this week was the case of the Muckanese Battle Horn. Have any of you ever seen that?
I remember that from my youth. We had that on a videotape in my house. And, of course, you've got all of the goons except Harry Secombe, who was unavailable and is replaced by...
Dick Emery.
Dick Emery, isn't he? Yeah.
That's right.
It's about 25 minutes, isn't it? Half hour.
That's right.
Sort of short
film. Yeah, about 25 minutes.
So the closest you'll get to the goons on film, really.
Yes, it is. It was even got sort of goons characters like Henry Crown and Minnie Bannister. And of course, Eccles makes a regular appearance. And yes, it was a good, fun 25 minutes. Really enjoyed it.
I haven't been up to an awful lot. I've been incredibly boring. But I did, however, spot that the local theatre group are putting on The Ghost Train by Arnold Ridley in the play in the local theatre.
Oh, brilliant.
That was the film was on TV recently, wasn't it?
The Arthur Askey film.
I'm not sure who was in it. I saw it was on.
Arthur Askey and Richard Murdoch are in the most well-known film adaptation. There's an earlier one, which I think the last remaining extant copy was in Bob Monkhouse's archive, which the police incinerated in the early 80s, because they're nice like that, and they confiscated all his films thinking he was going to distribute them. And it was the last existing copy starring, I think, was it Claude Hurlbut or his brother? But yeah, it's a well worth a watch. It's certainly the movie version, which I dug out of an old DVD wallet recently, is great fun. And I really like Dickie Murdoch. He's brilliant in radio, and I quite like seeing him on screen now and again.
I'm afraid my stuff's too high class for them. Hello, I see you got it to light.
Yes, we know how it works, and we found the cups, and we're doing very well, thank you very much.
All right, I was only trying to be useful, wasn't I, Miss... what did you say your name was?
The lady didn't say what her name was.
Well, I told her what my name was.
Well, that's no reason to come in here.
If it'll stop you two arguing, it's Winthrop. Jackie Winthrop.
Winthrop? Oh, the same as R.G. in there. Well, he's not your brother. And he's not your father. He can't be your sister, even if he does play hockey for Hampshire.
Look here, is this a cross-examination?
Oh, I don't mind.
Well, I do. This silly little man's done nothing but force his attentions on you ever since he lost his silly hat.
Well, I can't call her Miss What's-her-name. Besides, I was only trying to help.
Well, go and help the people in the other room.
I don't want to. Oh, no.
So I'm looking forward to going to see that at the end of the month.
Yeah, sounds great.
That'd be good, wouldn't it? Yeah, yeah. I was keeping a bit quiet because I couldn't remember anything I've been doing in the last few weeks. Actually, I don't think I've watched anything particularly exciting on TV. What I have been doing during the daytime is spending a lot of time sorting out the Society's archive because we was able to announce to members in January that we have found permanent home for our archive at last. After many, many years of trying to find a permanent home, the archive is going to be taken by the De Montfort University in Leicester. They have various other comedy archives and bits and pieces there, and they're quite pleased to take what we've got. We are going to retain ownership of it, but it'll be deposited with them for a period of time and see how it goes, basically. The good thing about this is that the archive, instead of being locked away that no one can see, will be available to academics, to students at the university, and indeed to the wider public, who will be able to see some stuff online, and by appointment will be able to go and see items. So that's really good news for us. It's really good news for society and for Hancock fans generally. But what it means is I've had to go through sorting out a lot of stuff here in preparation for it going, to make sure it's all properly catalogued and all that sort of thing. So, that's taken up much of my time recently, getting that done.
Got to make sure you don't mix your wine gums up with the archive and send all of those to De Montfort University as well.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I did have some packets of wine gums here. Perhaps I shall send them to Leicester. I think that'd be a good idea.
Well, particularly if you've got a packet of all black ones, Tim.
Indeed.
Because you can't always get them.
Right.
But no... Seriously, it's a great outcome because the archives, we've got extensive archives and they'll be in a place where, as Tim says, they're going to be accessible by lots of people. So it's a great place to have them. And huge thanks to the university for looking after these for us.
Yes, indeed. So then, I think it's time for some Hancock headlines. Is there anything in the news this week, Martin?
Well, we've got some very exciting news for our listeners this week. To celebrate what would have been Hancock's 100th birthday on the 12th of May, Radio 4 Extra will be broadcasting a two-hour special between 5pm and 7pm. This programme is going to include lots of extracts from programmes that haven't been repeated since the 1950s. So it's going to include an almost complete Star Bill, some extracts from Calling All Forces, and some other extracts from Star Bill as well. But most importantly, the programme's going to include the first broadcast since the mid-1950s of the long-lost radio episode A Visit to Swansea. I can't wait to hear that. It's going to be absolutely amazing. And if the two-hour programme's not enough, Radio 4 Extra are then going to repeat the three-hour Steve Punt's Hancock Cuttings. So that's going to be a complete 5 hours of Hancock material being broadcast on the 12th of May. So a really great birthday celebration from Radio 4 Extra. And then on the Friday before, they're going to be broadcasting two additional Hancock programmes. So at 10 o'clock on Friday, they will be broadcasting Hancock's Helpers, and at 10:30, Briars on Hancock. Two programmes that aren't very often repeated. So another great couple of programmes to celebrate Hancock's birthday. Really looking forward to it all. It's a fantastic way to celebrate the anniversary.
It's time for some tweets and emails. Do you have any interesting tweets you want to chat about, dudes?
Well, let me start off then with a tweet we received from a guy called Lawrence Burton a little while ago. This was basically, it was in response to a tweet I did about the Poetry Society. One of the things I like to do is to tweet the poets from the Poetry Society, you know, incandescence and all these sorts of things. And we always get great responses to them. And, Lead Pipes, Fortune Made is my favourite line.
That's a good one.
Poetry Society poem. It's great, isn't it? Anyway, Lawrence Burton came back and he said, "Oh, I was in a band which set this to music." So I went back for him and we exchanged some direct messages about this to get some further information. And basically, he was able to send me a track that a band that he was in recorded some years ago. The band was called Academy 23. And he says he wasn't actually in the band at the time they made this music. He's not saying he was on the recording. He was saying that the band were originally known as the Apostles and still have a bit of a cult following. And essentially, this track, which we are able to play a clip from, puts the poems of the Poetry Society to music. And it's great because we've heard a lot of tracks in the past where Hancock has been sampled in various ways. And I think we've mentioned this a couple of times in the podcast. But this one was completely under the radar. I mean, obviously, it's not a mass-produced CD or anything like some of the others are. But it's really interesting, and particularly if you like this particular band of music, which is probably a little bit more Martin than it is me, it's great to have.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. See what our listeners think.
I can't wait to hear it.
Roar in the wind, fly, fly, fly.
Quite a lot of these sort of referent and would have been referenced in the Year of the Cat, which was originally going to be about, you know, Tony Hancock, but the lyrics no longer exist as far as we know, and various other bits and pieces. It's quite interesting.
There's the George Michael one, isn't it?
The George Michael, was it Too Funky or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Baby Shambles. Not Baby Shambles. What's it called?
Pete Doherty.
Pete Doherty, his band.
Libertines.
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 Yeah.
Then you've got Dogstermore. They did a sample from Sunday Afternoon at Home.
It just shows you the significance of Hancock, doesn't it? The fact that all these different bands, and it is, you know, we're not talking about groups that were around in 1959 or 1961.
Oh, no.
It's much, you know, much more recent.
It's people, it's from the sort of 70s, 80s, people who remember it probably from when it was on they were kids. You know, there's even the Beatles mention it in that Get Back documentary, don't they, which is on Disney Plus, which I really must watch, but it's some 7 hours, isn't it? So,
yes. It's a great documentary.
Set it a whole day apart and watch it like a Clockwork Orange with the eyes like that, you know.
Yeah, could they reference they reference that they'd watched, is it Hancock
the Lift,
in the Lift,
the Lift,
the Lift, they referenced that they'd seen the Lift that was on the previous night as on a repeat on.
That's right, it was the repeat, the 69 repeat. But
there was a couple of others. I remember one of the bands was called Small Town Parade, and it was called A Sunday Way of Life. And then there was another band, and I'm desperately trying to remember what the other band was, but there's one more that did quite a large sample from one of the Hancock's half hours.
There's ones inspired by it, ones that use an image on the cover, like Phil Collins' album. Something like A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Heaven, I think, wasn't it? A single?
That sounds right.
Something Happened on the Way to Heaven, with a picture of Tony from the 1967 Australian series. That 67, 68 Australian series that came out posthumously. And of course, you've got songs like Mr. Homburg Hat and things like that, which reference him. So it's quite a big kind of influence on music.
And if any listeners know of any other tracks where Hancock's been sampled that have not previously been mentioned on the Society's webpage or here, then do let us know, because this one, you know, there's probably more to be unearthed.
Indeed.
Another tweet we had was from a guy called Graham Perry. Now, going back to the formation of the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society, we had our 45th anniversary recently, because the society was formed in 1975 by a group of fans up in Newcastle. Or the
76, wasn't it?
76.
76, that's right. So it's a group of fans up in Newcastle, in the northeast, formed this group. And I remember that... one of our members who's been in it from the start, a guy called Bob Bray, said that he saw an advert in a magazine at the time called Titbits. And Titbits was one of these popular magazines that went out every week, I think it was. And someone put an advert in there saying, we're thinking of forming a Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. If you think this is for you, get in touch. And that's how Bob got in touch. And he's been in the society ever since. But I heard from Graham Perry, who says that in 1973, he put an ad in the Times suggesting the formation of a Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. And he said that a few of them got together, including a BBC presenter, couldn't remember her name, and they tried to set something up, but needless to say, it didn't work. But he did say that he received a phone call from Freddie Ross, and apparently Freddie wasn't too happy at the idea of a Tony Hancock Appreciation Society being advertised in the Times in that way. I'm not quite sure what her issue was at the time, although she later did become great friends with the society and come to at least one of our annual dinners. So this was 3 years before the society was actually set up, and that someone else had a go. So
That's really interesting. Not heard that story before.
No, it came as a complete shock to me. Mm. It made me wonder whether anyone in the 60s had tried to do something. But setting things up in those days was, of course, much more difficult without internet and social media and things.
Maybe there's an underground Tony Hancock Appreciation Society we don't know about on the dark web, Tim.
Yeah, on the dark web.
On the dark web, yeah.
When I do, yeah.
I mean, we'll ask you, Tim, because you seem to know. Yeah.
Well, I'm the expert on it.
Well, yeah. I'm sure there were Charlie Chaplin fan clubs and sort of... say Norman Wisdom fan clubs around in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. So it wouldn't entirely surprise me, but it would be a slightly different entity, maybe more sort of about raising that person's appearance and, you know, going to events to see said person, you know. So it'd be a whole different entity to a posthumous society like our own. But, you know, only 5 years after he died. So quite early. And obviously the society was only Was it eight years after he died? Yeah, it would have been 8 years after he died that we were we started.
That's right.
You remember it well, don't you, Martin? Yeah.
I think I was about 1980 I joined, so it wasn't far after the beginning.
Not far off.
It's not far off. Saw it advertised on the back of one of the LP records that came out. So that's how I heard about it.
I think I remember my being very young and my dad telling me about it. He wasn't a member at the time. But I can remember, always knew you guys existed, but
Well, similarly, my dad was a one-time member at some point in the 80s. And, I've still got his four or five railway cuttings issues knocking around here somewhere. And I joined this century, but only just. So quite a while ago now. Similarly, had always been aware of a sort of fan club appreciation site and seen the old website prior to our current one, which is being revamped shortly. Long old time, eh?
Yeah.
Indeed.
And I also had an email from a guy called Stephen Habey, who's one of our new members, and he joins us from Hughesdale in Victoria, Australia. Yeah. And so he's
Welcome
to Stephen. He's one of our happy band of Australian members, because obviously Hancock was very popular in Australia. And he said that the first episode he listened to was from one of these double BBC cassettes, with Fred's Pie Store and Hancock in the police and that. But what he actually goes on to say, which I thought was quite funny, he said that to this day, I will, during staff meetings with my team, often drop a Hancock's half-hour phrase or two. And I do that as well, you know, when you pick these things up in life, don't you? You know, it's not so much a catchphrase as you find yourself using an expression. And I just wondering whether you guys do any of that, or whether any of our listeners drop into Hancock in any certain circumstance.
Well, I have to say, very proud of my daughter, because one of her colleagues she works with came back after having to have a blood test or giving blood, and she said, "Did you give very nearly an armful?" To which she got a completely blank expression. She remembered it was very nearly an armful, so I was very impressed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I drop in what I can, but it's usually I go, with a what?
That's
the one I sort of drop in regularly.
Yeah. There's certain phrases that I quite like to repeat, various bits and pieces, but I do quite like you're just like everybody else, really. You don't like you either. Which is a phrase that I like to repeat now and again.
Well, one of the ones I use is, he's right, you know, or she's right, you know, if... What's the other one? I often call people matey, which I think is a Hancock thing, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
It's not unique, perhaps.
So if no one else gets this in my work colleagues. So if we've had a meeting and it's wrapped up, and my boss, okay, that go right? Went another good one.
Another good one, Roddy.
Another good one, Roddy.
I don't say Roddy, because I go, what the earth are you talking about? Another good one, boss.
Good if your boss was called Ronnie, though.
You've got to put the Ronnie at the end, James.
I got to try. I'll try next time. I'll try and record myself doing it.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I don't do this very often, but I think Chickadee Snitch, we better move on.
And, well, let's move on and move backwards, because I can now tell you the name of the other band. It was a 1976 album called Modern Music and a band called Bebop Deluxe.
Oh, right.
And it was Extracts from a Sunday Afternoon at Home.
Yeah, I've heard that one, I think, in recent years.
Yeah. And then, of course, we mustn't forget Richard Digance.
Mr. Homburg Hat.
That was Harvey Andrews did Mr. Homburg Hat.
Oh, it's Harvey Andrews.
And Richard Digance just did a song called Tony Hancock.
I see.
Which we have in the archive.
Yeah, that was released as a single, and I think Mr. Homburg Hat by Harvey Andrews was released as a B-side to a single, but I can't remember what the A-side was.
There we go.
So lots and lots of musical tributes over the years, which is just lovely, really.
So when we send our archive to the Universe DMU in Leicester, I won't be able to pop one of these records out and put it on the turntable any time I want to, will I?
Not unless you've got spares.
No.
No. There's a few unique ones there. I guess it's time for our main subject, the new nose. So what did you think of this one, guys?
Well, I thought this is a really interesting episode because clearly I think Ray and Alan are using the fact that this is a recorded episode to their great advantage, because Tony's got to have all of the makeup done to have his replacement nose towards the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And I think this is the fourth episode of the fourth series. All of the first three series were all broadcast live, and the series penultimate episode of the previous series was There's an Airfield at the Bottom of My Garden, where it's well known that the set collapsed rather at the wrong time during the episode, and Tony said, oh, I want to record my episodes going forward. Well, he got his way to some extent, because the first four of this series were recorded, and then it reverted to live for the rest of the series. But for this fourth episode, Ray and Alan have him with a brand new nose three quarters of the way through the episode, which I guess would have been incredibly difficult to achieve with a live episode.
But this wasn't recorded on tape in the way that they did from the fourth series on.
No, but they were able to do it in segments, weren't they?
Yeah, so what it says in Weber's book, 50 Years of Hancock's Half Hour, is that it was tele-recorded in segments.
Yeah.
Now, that's the first time I've heard that expression, because I know when they had this early version of videotape, it was done in segments, and they learned how to edit it. But it's the first time I sort of realised that with tele-recording, obviously, you can stop and start the film, can't you?
That's right.
Yeah.
It was far, far easier to edit on film than on videotape. I think there's an early William Hartnell Doctor Who, which was filmed live, as it were, as if a stage play in segments in sort of three or four scenes. But because of the amount of action and bits and pieces in that particular one, rather than videotape it, record it onto tape, they tele-recorded it and edited the tele-recording for broadcast. And a similar thing would have happened with this program. It would have been essentially performed live with a film recorder recording from a monitor at the time, and then they'd have assembled it subsequently. And I think it really works quite well. It's sort of fairly dynamic.
But in theory, had there been the idea to do it, they could have done that much earlier, couldn't they? Because the Alpine Holiday was from Series 2, and they only tele-recorded that for training purposes or technical reasons. But in theory, they could have tele-recorded the whole of Series 2 in segments, couldn't they, when you think about
it? In theory, the quality of tele-recordings had improved sufficiently by 1958 that it wasn't that noticeable that it was a recording, whereas earlier things that were tele-recorded, such as the first two episodes of the Quatermass experiment from 1953, the quality of the recording of that, and of course the quality of the recording of the Alpine Holiday, are much more subpar than later programs because of the type of the technology with it improves, the white heat of technology, as things do with, in the modern day with Zoom and stuff. You couldn't imagine doing this 10 years ago, could you, chaps?
Oh, no. Definitely not. But then I thought the rest of it was fascinating, because the rest of the series after this one was broadcast live. Mm. But we know that all of them were recorded, with the exception of the last
one. Because they were repeated.
This was broadcast in January, and they were all repeated later in the year. So every episode from this series ended up being recorded. Apart from, we don't know about The Servants, because The Servants was the only one from the series that wasn't repeated later in the year.
Yeah. And it's the only one that doesn't exist in any form from the series. I think all the others exist as sound recordings that people made at home, of varying degrees of quality, from pretty good to, it's like putting a digestive biscuit on a record player. So it varies quite a bit. But I think the thing with the recordings is the intention was to record four of them in advance and pepper them through the series so Tony could have a break between episodes. But in the end, they just broadcast them in order for whatever reason.
That's right. All the recorded ones went first, didn't they? And then looking at the script, it looked like they allocated an hour for recording. Now, obviously, all the live performances for the first three series would have been half an hour exactly.
Yeah.
So they allowed an hour for all four of these episodes to be recorded. So that must have been, as you say, the recording in, what did you call them? Recorded in batches or segments or whatever you want to call it.
Segments,
that was it. Scene by scene. So which would have given them a chance to sort out Tony's nose.
Exactly, yes.
For the appropriate scene at the end.
I think segments is the word that one of the biographers used. I think it's Fisher or someone used that.
Segments, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or you could say chunks.
It's a way that a lot of drama was done. You know, they do one whole scene like a stage play, and only if something went terribly, terribly wrong would they go back to the beginning and start again, which you can do much more easily with drama than with comedy, because, of course, with comedy, you've got an audience, and if they don't react the second time you're doing it, it doesn't quite work as well, does it?
No, that's right.
Of course, well, this one opens with the wonderful Annabelle Lee, who appeared in about five or six episodes of Hancock's Half Hour. This is her first one she was in, playing the girlfriend at the beginning. She was subsequently as Gladys in The Big Night, first girl in the Spanish Interlude.
Yeah.
Mrs. Frobisher in The Babysitters, and Edie in The Ladies' Man.
In The Ladies' Man,
So, Annabelle, we have a recording of Annabelle from 1996 talking at, a Hancock Midlands convention or something. She doesn't remember much about this era, but I'll pop in a little clip here.
I don't know when you last saw that, that clip.
I can't remember. Years ago, I think. Yes.
It's still a fresh memory to you. You still remember that clinch with our tone?
Well, yes, but please don't push me on that. I can't remember. I really can't remember. To me, it was a job, you know, obviously. And it's only afterwards that you think, oh, goodness, I wish I'd remembered more. I wish I'd taken more notice of things instead of, you know. I mean, obviously, I enjoyed it and I was a great fan of his. And still am, but there's not a lot I can remember.
Well, it's often said about Hancock, and I think Hancock also said himself that during the first rehearsal for the run-through, that was as funny as when we saw the final version.
I think sometimes funnier, because I remember I was absolutely fascinated watching him all the time during rehearsal, and he would do things that you'd think, oh, God, that's so good, that is so good. And then it wouldn't happen again. He'd change. He was evolving and he was finding his way and all the rest of it. But sometimes I'd regret moments of sadness, I think, particularly. Maybe they said, oh, don't make it too sad, Tony, or something like, I don't know. But sometimes there would be real pathos there, and I'd be really moved watching it. And then he didn't do it again. And I often wondered why, because he was so inventive within himself. And I think he just went on, and bits got discarded, and maybe there were bits that I particularly liked, and it didn't happen again, you know.
It's quite interesting that she doesn't remember much about it, because I know we had the same conversation with Laurie Webb when we spoke to him. And these actors, you know, it was just a job they did. They came in. This would have involved rehearsing and filming overall period of about a week, from Monday to Friday or whatever. And then she would have come into that from another job, and she would have gone on to something else afterwards. And, you know, it's just what they did. And obviously, when Annabelle was speaking in 1990, whatever it was, you know, it was still about 40-odd years afterwards. It's not surprising that people can't really remember much about it. But, yeah, she was a great actress, and I loved her performances in all the episodes she did. I think in the clip we heard Annabelle, she was asked about the fact that she was in a romantic situation with Hancock, which of course is something you don't normally see. Not that he succeeded very well. I mean, that's the whole point, I guess. You don't normally see him getting much further than a slap round the ear, do you? But
he sells trying to be quite romantic quite well initially at the beginning, doesn't he? He's doing all the right moves. I mean, I'd not that I base my moves on Hancock, because I definitely wouldn't get anywhere, but moves such as I have them. I think there's a certain element of pathos in there at the beginning there, where he's being quite serious and stuff.
Well, I love that line. He turns to her and says, "There is a man behind you, beside you, a handsome rogue of a fellow."
Handsome rogue of a fellow.
Think of a hot summer's night. The moon shining through the trees. A waft of soft, cool air flits across the moonlit sea. There's a man beside you, a handsome rogue of a fellow.
And of course, the moment where she's, oh, I love cider. What do you mean cider?
Oh, that's
this is champagne. How do you know it was cider? Then he detweets. Yeah. So yes, that's a good one. Because that's used, I think, in a radio episode as well about cider, I'm sure. I can't quite remember which one off the top of my head.
All the boys give me cider.
Yeah.
Guess we go in.
We're all does it now.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's lovely, isn't it? I love cider, don't you?
Cider, what do you mean, cider? This is the finest vintage champagne for me. How did you know it was cider?
Oh, the boys give me cider when I go to parties. They say it gets me going.
Well, come on then, drink it up, my dear. Yes, get it down, you, my love. Yes.
It's funny because John Fisher mentions this in his biography of Hancock, and he describes Hancock as being the master of sudden shift. And he gives this example about when Hancock says, oh, you know, this is not cider, this is the finest vintage champagne. Then a split seconds later, he says, how do you know it was cider? And he shifts his position. And he gave another example of it in the publicity photograph, the radio episode, when he says, he has split one of my legs down the middle. He has, you know. And again, it's that sudden shift. And I thought that was an interesting thing that Fisher was talking about. And you get that quite a lot in Hancock's Half Hour, apart from these two examples.
I think the photo's a very good likeness. I'm particularly impressed by the way he's captured the beauty of my legs. He didn't think they were photogenic at the time. In fact, he was quite nasty about it. But he's done well. They've turned out very slim.
Do you notice the insides of them are straight?
What about it?
You know what I think?
What?
He's taken one, split it down the middle, and moved it over.
He has not. He has, you know. You're dead right, he has. Look, I've only got 2.5 toes on each foot.
A little shift in tone, just of like I've tweaked or he's been tweaked.
Yeah. A complete shift in his thinking, isn't it?
Is a real show of, again, because I haven't seen this as much as I've listened to it on the radio version, but when I'm listening to it, you can always imagine the facial expressions are great, and they are great, aren't they, when you watch it? Like I say, you can really see that shift when he's sort of the dashing in seduction mode, then suddenly gets a knockback and he's the confused face.
But then you also get the shift, of course, when she can't stop laughing and he throws her out.
Yeah, he says, go on, op it.
Op it.
Op it. He's been trying it on all nice and charming. All of a sudden, the real Hancock comes out. Yeah.
And I'll have the chocolates back. doesn't let her keep the chocolates.
Oh, this is ridiculous. How can you make love to somebody who keeps giggling all the time? Go on, op it. I'll have me chocolates back as well.
Well, what a cheek. Now we're seeing the other side of your nature. So this is what you're really like, is it?
Yes, it is. Now go on, go home.
I think as well, just the way, I mean, I think they sell quite well how the two ladies at the beginning and end of the episode laugh at him. I think it's a little bit left of field, isn't it? Suddenly noticing someone's nose.
Or their ears.
But it really works well. And of course, I really love the subsequent scene where he goes to a cafe and subsequently a bus stop and overhears other people's conversations about completely unrelated people, be it, you know, that bloke Roger or whoever it might be who's got a huge hooter and stuff like that. And then obviously Alec Bregons and his friend at the bus stop saying, oh, you seen the clown in the circus? Hooter? Oh, it's like a grapefruit on the end of his nose kind of thing. And just the reactions to that.
Oh, what did you think of that clown?
Oh, very funny. Grotesque, isn't he?
Oh, he's a scream to look at, isn't he? What about that nose, then?
I'm not sure that bit works with a clown. Yeah, I like the other bits, but I think the clown bit seems a bit weird, really, to me. Two blokes standing at a bus stop talking about...
A little bit forced, perhaps?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it
was. Have you seen the circus? No, but I've seen it on telly. I don't know how often the circus was on telly, but...
Yeah, telly. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. It doesn't feel as though that works quite so well. But did you notice that when you've got Liz Fraser and I forgot the other lady's name in the cafe, and Tony goes in and he says...
Pamela Benson.
Pamela, and he goes in and he asks for his he goes in for his meat pie, that the person behind the counter serving him is the same guy who then comes around to his house later to say, look at my new nose.
Good old Roger Avon.
Roger Avon.
He serves Sid with the glass of milk, doesn't he, in the same...
That's right.
Cafe, yeah.
It's in the same cafe.
Well,
so Tony didn't... So Tony goes up to him and asks for his meat pie, and then later gets introduced to him at home. So slight continuity issue with that bit.
There is, and Pamela Manson, of course, is... All of her other episodes, barring the economy drive, are lost, which was The Wrong Man and The Adopted Family. But in the economy drive, she's the one behind the canteen who's been doing replenishing.
Yeah. She's the one with a cigarette in her mouth, isn't she?
Yeah.
Hygienic establishment, this is.
This is hygienic, yes.
Yes.
You handled that. You've got a rabbit now.
I don't want it. It's hard.
You handled it. This is a hygienic establishment. I can't pass that on to somebody else.
Oh, all right.
I was just going to say, she's also in Dad's Army. She was a tea lady at a training centre they went to. She was in Reggie Perrin. And she also popped up in an episode of The Good Life on one occasion too. So she was she was around in sitcoms in the 70s as well.
Yeah. And then you were talking of Roger Avon, who plays Arthur Dillwater, which is a wonderful name from Galton Simpson again, isn't it?
Yeah. They love using the names, don't they?
Roger Avon is a very recognisable man, is that actor. I mean, he's been in Doctor Who on the telly, Doctor Who, the Dark Invasion of Earth movie.
Cinema.
Been in Father, Dear Father, I think it was. He's probably in a Steptoe or something. Just a bit player who is in lots of stuff, particularly in the 60s, 70s, and to some extent up to the 80s, but a very sort of distinctive-looking man, isn't he? He's sort of, you know, got that kind of bruiser look.
He was in one of my favourite films, which was A Hard Day's Night with the Beef.
Oh, was he?
He played a policeman in that, yeah.
Okay.
Fairly sure he plays a policeman in Steptoe and Son as well. I think he's in the one where Harold always gets his head turned by a fey gay gentleman who's chatting him up. He's the policeman at the end, I think. Old Roger Avon.
Oh, is he? Okay. Yeah. I'm going to have to look that one up. We've already mentioned Alec Bregonzi, and then, of course, you've got Mario Fabrizi as the Milton.
Yeah.
And the absolutely brilliant John Le Mesurier as the Doctor.
Well, with Mario, did you realise he's in 22 of these episodes? That's incredible. I hadn't realised that.
There's a list in the book. He was in a lot of them.
Well, he's a real regular, isn't he?
Yeah. I love it when the Hancock pays the Milton through the letterbox and the stuff. I think it's a lovely little scene.
Yeah. Particularly that line, have I done something to upset you, Mr. Hancock? You don't have to talk to me anymore. Never mind. Slams the letterbox down.
To which he says, mind your own business. Go away.
Such a good scene, that is. Such a good scene.
Mr. Milton, how much do you want today?
Half a pint. Leave it on the step.
It's Saturday, Mr. Hancock. Would you like to pay for the rest of the week? It's 2 and 9, please.
Oh, hang on a minute.
Thank you. 2 and 9, 3 shillings, 5, 7, 6, 10, and 10 is 20.
Thank you.
Have I done anything to upset you, Mr. Hancock? Why don't you open the door to me any more these days?
Mind your own business.
Played like a proper recluse.
And then the little moment of the hand.
Yeah. The hand coming round to find the milk bottle.
The hand coming round feeling for the milk bottle. That's a good one.
But have you noticed he only has half a pint for the day?
Well, he obviously doesn't have cereal. He must have toast for breakfast.
He must have toast for breakfast.
He must have toast for breakfast, just for the cups of tea.
Yeah, because he only had half a pint the day before, because that's the empty that he puts out. It's only a small bottle again.
Right.
So he's obviously not a big...
I never noticed that. Right.
He's not a big milk drinker. Obviously Sid is, because he goes in and has his glass of milk in the cafe. But, with the extra top... With the extra top up on top.
Top of scotch out of his hip flask.
Yeah.
Not paying attention to his drink a pint of milk a day.
Exactly.
He did on the...
Exactly. There's a great line as well from Roger Avon where he goes, you know, him and Sid are talking about, oh, blimey, your nose used to be out here, you know, off a foot long or whatever. He's, you know, it's done bags for me confidence.
Don't you notice anything about me, Sid?
No.
Go on, you must have a good look.
You've had your hair cut.
No, look, can't you see anything?
No.
The nose!
Oh, blimey, yes. What have you done to it? You used to have the biggest hooter in East Cheam. Where's it gone?
I had it done.
What do you mean, done?
Plastic surgery. Had a bit chipped off it. Marvellous, innit? Doctor said it was affecting me. He was giving me a complex. It was affecting my mental stability. So he gives me a chit and I go along and have it done. I've got bags of confidence now.
He said you used to have the biggest hooter in East Cheam.
What is that bar that Sid's at, which is, God, I can't get a drink at 10:30? What is it? Is it a coffee shop? It's not a pub, is it?
Maybe it's a pub, but they...
I thought it's a cafe. No, it's not a pub, I don't think. You wouldn't get a glass of milk in a pub, would you?
No.
Oh, blimey, what a country this is. 10:30, a man can't get a drink.
What do you want, Sid?
I don't know.
What about a milkshake?
Oh, do me a favour.
Raspberry, strawberry, blackcurrant.
Give me a glass of milk, don't fill it up.
Yeah,
I think it's a cafe, and he's just saying, I can't get a drink anywhere.
Yeah,
not presumably 58. The pubs would have been shut at that time, I would guess. Thinking of the, and I don't, for listeners, if you've got this episode on the BBC DVD collection, it has been slightly edited. The BBC did a series of edits for video release in the 1980s to try and it just. And I'm going to use speech marks around improve the speed of the episode. And one of the lines that were cut was the end of the sequence with Liz Fraser and Pamela Manson, which is no longer on the BBC DVD. But that's a great finish.
She goes, what's the matter with him? Oh, I don't know. He's probably drunk, doesn't she? Yeah.
He's probably drunk. Absolutely. Yeah, sort of a why doesn't he mind his own business, you know?
Coffee house Jezebels. Yeah.
He wants to learn to mind his own business.
The edits were done and overseen, I think, by Galton Simpson. But I looked at the episode, and of course, the original runtime is 31.5 minutes, and the edit gets it down to 30 minutes. So it may have also been done for rebroadcast in the 80s. And it seems to be mainly short little bits around scene transition. So there's that little bit at about 10 minutes. There's the fade to blacks and scene changes are slightly shortened, you know, just phase one into the other rather than fading down to black.
Particularly the bit around the hospital where he's being wheeled into the operating theatre. I think that is one of the biggest bits that's shortened.
Oh, right, that's gone.
The main bit that's the line is Mr. Reginald Coote, played by Arthur Mullard, who's once Tony leaves, goes, "Morning, Doctor, I want Elvis Presley."
Next patient, please.
Mr. Reginald Coote.
Yes?
Good morning, Doctor. I want an Elvis Presley.
Because he's a commercial television announcer.
I love that line when he says that.
Mm.
And
his nose doesn't suit his job.
No, yeah, my conk doesn't suit my job.
I'm a commercial television announcer. Of course, my conk don't suit my job.
Oh, what do you do?
I'm a commercial television announcer.
Also, how efficient is the NHS? That's
well, exactly.
Coming on Tuesday. And he's 100 guineas, though, wasn't he? He tried to charge her 100 guineas.
They were private. He got old Arthur got a chip from the doctor because it impacted his mental health. But Tony, well, he obviously his doctor was a bit less forgiving and wouldn't give him a chit.
Yeah, 100 guineas. But after Arthur Mullard has said, I want an Elvis Presley, the reaction from John Lemez's face, complete disdain and... You know, heaven help me.
Another one
asking for an Elvis Presley.
John Lemez is terrific in this, isn't he? I mean, what a character actor.
He plays a fantastic doctor. Well, he plays a fantastic a lot of things, but especially a doctor. Yeah. And he's just firm enough as well.
He is. And I like the line, that particularly one of his last lines, where he's like, oh, well, you know, we're all here to sort of help people and stuff. That'd be 100 guineas, please. Immediately sort of turning for his fee.
He says, it's a profession in which it's a privilege to serve. 100 guineas, please.
please. Yeah, all in one breath, isn't it?
You've been absolutely marvellous.
Ah, not at all, not at all. It's all part of the dedicated service provided by dedicated men. A profession and all in which we are all proud to have the privilege to serve. 100 guineas, please.
Yes, I've come to send you. I'm going home to get everything fixed up for him.
But I love the line. I love the line where he says, "Perhaps you'd like to look at the pattern book." And then he's got this book of pictures of noses.
Nothing flashy, of course.
I think I'm the best judge of that.
I'm sorry.
I'm a man for my good taste.
Yes, of course. I apologise.
Oh, now, perhaps you'd like to have a look through the pattern book.
By all means.
Now, I expect there's something here that might appeal to you.
Yes.
I really like the how it's like going to the tailor, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, I'll have that one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then he says... Tony says, oh, this is a straight up and a downer. And then John says, oh, no, this is aquiline, to which Tony says, oh, does that mean you can use it underwater?
Yes.
No.
Just brilliant. Although, I don't know if you noticed, I mean, Tony had described himself as aquiline earlier in the episode, so that came up twice. But I did think that was good.
That's quite a good one. That's what you might call a straight up and a downer.
Well, in the profession, we call it aquiline.
Aquiline? That means you can use it underwater, doesn't it? Very good for spear fishing, I should say.
No, that's not what it means.
What I like as well is when you first see him, he's got the sign on the door that says Dr. Francis Worthington, noses a specialty.
Like a painter and decorator might have, for example.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I think one of the better lines in the doctor's office is where he's doing the measurements. Since 1 1/4 base across the nose, or where can I have 1 1/4? You know, I like a wide fitting.
Yes, will you take these measurements for me, please? Width of bridge, 5/8. Base of nose, 1 1/8.
Oh, do you mind if I have 1 1/4 there? I like a wide fitting.
Make that 1 1/4, will you, nurse, please?
And what colour would you like it?
Same as the face.
Pasty white.
Finally, colouring. What do you think?
Oh, I don't know, something about the same shade as the face, eh?
As you wish. Pasty white.
My favourite line from that sequence is when he says... A Roman nose goes very well with short jackets and pointed shoes.
The shoes.
What, winkle pickers? Nice.
Yeah. I used to wear them.
He says, yes, very Mark Antony.
Yeah, he said, very Mark Antony with a touch of Charlie Chester, which was a lovely little look. Because, I mean, Charlie Chester was well known, and he did radio shows from the 1940s right through to the 90s.
With Hancock, too.
But with Hancock, because he was co-host with Tony Hancock in Calling All Forces in 1951. So the Charlie and Tony had worked together for, I don't know how many weeks it was they were co-host. It wasn't very many, about 10 or 12 weeks, something like that. But I thought that was really good.
There's quite a few recordings of those, isn't there, which were discovered and are available on the Hancock's Half Hour Collectibles CD box sets, which
are
highly recommended for your interesting rarities you will otherwise never get to hear.
And in fact, the only one of those episodes that survives in its entirety is also on a download release from Penguin called Calling All Forces, which has got a selection from from the archive. Runs for about 15 or 16 hours, something like that. So quite a big collection.
Enough to keep you busy for half a day.
Also, in the doctor's surgery, of course, we have Anne Marriott playing the nurse.
Yes.
A role she also played in The Blood Donor. I was looking her up as well. She was in 14 Hancock's Half Hours. I mean, it just seems incredible. She didn't have a speaking role in all of them, but was quite a regular.
5 of those were nurses. I was reading Richard Webber's lovely book, 50 Years of Hancock's Half Hour, and Richard interviewed Anne for said book. And she says, you know, she was always playing these sort of secretaries, you know, sort of vaguely figures of authority. And in fact, her husband worked in the production team of Hancock's Half Hour, which might be how she those roles. Right. So that's how she became involved in it.
Oh, okay.
Or she might have got him the job in a production team, John.
Well, I feel the former came first, but I don't know. I don't know. But she was in quite a few, and I think she said about the blood donor how she'd have liked to have reacted to the stupid things Tony's character was saying, but who just had to sort of melt into the background and play with some instruments or something in the end, some medical instruments.
Yeah. Mr. Hancock here?
Hancock, yes, that's me.
Dr. Worthington will see you now.
Oh, thank you very much.
Mr. Hancock.
Oh, sit down, will you please, Mr. Hancock?
Oh, fine.
No, please, please. Please, Mr. Hancock, please come back. I do apologize. Please forgive me, but you rather took me by surprise.
One interesting thing about Anne Marriott, and indeed Annabel Lee, is that in Roger Wilmot's book, the cast list at the back has them the wrong way round and shows Anne Marriott as the first woman on the sofa and Annabel Lee as the second, which of course is the wrong way round. When I looked in Richard Weber's book, he's got them the wrong way round too. So I thought, ha-ha, he's copied Wilmot and whatever. But then I had a little idea, and you may remember that some time ago we were given access to the BBC Written Archives at Caversham. And one of the documents that I searched out for a number of programmes is one called the PASB, the Programme as Broadcast Sheet. And that is like a historical record of, after the programme goes out, who was in it. And various other bits and pieces of detail. But that actually gives them the wrong way round as well. So I suspect that Wilmot and Weber did their research at Caversham and probably got the PASBs, and that's how they got wrong.
And that's how it happened.
Yeah.
So interestingly, so they've got Anne Marriott down as the nurse correctly. What they've got is Annabel Lee as the second girl at Tony's Win, as it should be the first, and Barbara Archer is the first girl.
Sorry, I meant Barbara Archer. Yes, I said Anne Marriott, didn't I? Yes, I meant Barbara Archer.
So presumably Barbara Archer's the second girl. But interesting that that's the wrong way round on the PASBs as well.
Yeah?
Because I hadn't come across... I don't think Barbara Archer's in any of the other Hancock's Half-Hours. I'm not aware of her being in any others. And I looked her up, and am I right in saying that she was in Dracula with Christopher Lee?
Yeah, I think that was what she was...
1958?
They said that's what she's famous for.
This should be my area of expertise. I shall have a quick look. Yeah. She was only in the one episode of Hancock's Half Hour, and she played Inga in Dracula in 1958. Yes. That's one of my favourite films.
And in Up the Junction in 68?
Yes, Up the Junction she was in, and 633 Squadron as well, I noticed.
Apparently Up the Junction was her last credit on IMDb.
That was Dennis Waterman, wasn't it, Up the Junction?
I don't think I've ever seen
it. Don't know.
Yeah, it was Dennis Waterman. You're not making it up. Yeah, there's a picture of him on the IMDb. Yeah. There you go, young Dennis Waterman.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
Who was also in a Dracula film.
Was he?
Yeah, The Scars of Dracula. He played the young hero lead in The Scars of Dracula, which had Patrick Troughton in it, too. It had a bigger role for Michael Ripper. Michael Ripper, who was in the Punch and Judy Band with Tony playing the waiter. 6 degrees of Tony Hancock. The other great line from that whole scene with the measurements of the nose is, he says, well, we can always let it down a bit if it's not long enough, like you would with a pair of trousers or something.
Length of nose, 1 7/8. We can always let it down a bit if it's not long enough.
I think the props department did a really good job on that nose, actually, because I think it looked quite realistic when they took the bandages off.
Oh, yeah? It was very, very well done.
Mm. For 50s television.
Because it must have been a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah. It's a lot of Play-Doh.
Could they if it was an hour to record it, that still wasn't very long to do that.
So.
Makeup to get it looking right. And it was an absolutely brilliant job.
And I think also acting with it as well, because I think just for me, just the thought of having a plasticine nose on my face, obviously not an actor or anything, but I would probably be a bit more rigid in my movement, but he still had good fluidity of his movement, didn't he?
He was brilliant. Yes, absolutely.
Sid, I'm scared. I'm deuced scared.
All right, now take it easy, boy. Nothing to worry about. Here we go.
What a smasher!
Is it all right?
Is it all right? It's sensational. What a difference.
You're joking.
Don't touch it. It's a work of art.
Well, give me the mirror then. Let me have a look at it.
I don't know what they'd have used to make it. I think in the early days of Hollywood, people like Lon Chaney used to use stuff like mortician's putty, which you could shape and would look sufficiently like skin for black and white cameras. So maybe it was that. I doubt it would have been a kind of a rubber prosthetic or anything specifically manufactured. I imagine they made it on the day.
Yep.
But it is hideous, isn't it? I mean, I never really noticed it so much when I watched this as a kid, but as an adult, you're like, oh, God, it's awful. I don't know, quite. It's like a bit Merchant of Venice. I'm not quite sure quite what it is, but it's the it's ugliest like mine, looking John. Nose they can make. Yeah, just like yours, actually. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You and Tony Hancock, like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that final version, because he said he wanted to have a David Niven with a tiniest hint of Rosanna Bratsy about the nostrils.
Or a James Griffith.
Or a James Griffith.
Or indeed, or a James. Or a James. So,
Never thought of plastic surgery.
You can choose any shaped nose you like.
Yes. Yes, I could have a Robert Taylor or a Burt Lancaster or a David Niven with just the tiniest hint of Rosanna Bratsy about the nostrils.
Certainly could.
I was going to say, I know David Niven of old because, you know, he's a very, very well-known actor. Rosano Brazzi was a bit new to me. I had to look him up. He's an Italian actor who was best known for South Pacific and the Barefoot Contessa, which I think was mentioned in the Hancock's Half Hour, if memory serves me correctly. But I can't remember which one.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think he was in Three Coins in a Fountain as well, which was, I think, is right. his first Hollywood film.
His big hit.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And the other thing I had to look up was Arthur Mullard saying his wife wants him to have an Elvis Presley, but he would prefer retroussé.
Retroussé.
Which I had no idea what that meant.
Yeah.
Which is a turned up nose.
Oh, well.
What shape are you having there?
I don't know. I haven't made my mind up yet.
My wife wants me to have it done like Elvis Presley. Personally speaking, I prefer it as the French say.
Yes, I think they're very attractive.
I had no idea what that was. I'd never come across that term before.
No.
Retroussé.
R-E-T-R-O-U-S-E or double E, not sure which. I couldn't quite work out what Arthur Mullard was saying. I had to look that one up on the script before I looked it up. But, yeah.
Arthur does have a distinct accent. He's an entertaining performer in these sort of roles.
Yeah, I mean, he always plays a very similar role in Hancock's Half Hour, or indeed probably whatever he was doing.
Everything he ever made, yeah.
Absolutely.
One toy.
I'm thinking of singing the songs from Greece with Hilda Baker and all the rest, which he was playing very much the same sort of character in.
My favourite version of that song.
There we are. There's another clip you can insert here, then, John.
I got chills, they're multiplying, and I'm losing control. Course of power, you're supplying. It's electrified.
You better shape up, cause I need a man. Oh, and my heart is set on you. Better shape up, you better understand. To my heart, I must be true.
Nothing left for me to do.
You're the one that I want. You're the one that I want.
So did you notice, like to look at similarities between episodes, what he was wearing for the ladies? He was wearing his dragon print dressing gown.
Yes.
Which sounded very like the dragon print dressing gown that he was wearing when the dragon smudged in the marriage bureau.
I'm fairly sure he's wearing the same dressing gown in the dream sequence from the ladies man. Almost certainly the same prop.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Yeah. I wonder if it's not a prop and I wonder if it's his own. If they mentioned it in a radio episode, it might be something. Because didn't Freddie say that when he was interviewed, he always wore like some sort of dressing gown like that and a cigar holder and everything. Freddie said that in an interview. So I wonder whether it was perhaps his own and they used to take the mickey out of him for it and it was used in the episode.
Oh, that's quite possible, isn't it?
Mm. Well, yeah. Or even if not, he had one and they used that concept and ran with it in the shows and found a very similar one.
Yeah, could have done.
This, you never know, because, of course, just having the one prop, if it gets damaged, I mean, I was reading about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy at a slight tangent, but the television version of that used a specific dressing gown. However, they only had one of it, and they couldn't, it had been discontinued, so they couldn't get a replica or a second version of the dressing gown for Arthur Dent. So it's that one same dressing gown that had to be looked after very carefully for the run of six shows, because I imagine it was quite stinky and tatty by the end of it.
Yes, it certainly had to go through lots of adventures, didn't it?
So, I quite like talking about references to other episodes where he's asking Sid about his nose. You know, as a friend, you'd tell me if I had an ugly nose, wouldn't you? And he says, yeah, it's hideous. He says, yours isn't exactly a gem of architectural beauty either, is it?
Yes. Yeah. Lovely line, isn't it?
It's the aesthetic quality of it I'm worried about. I want your opinion as to the shape of it, its proportions with regard to the rest of the features.
Oh, well, in that case, it's horrible.
It is not horrible. This is a perfectly good nose.
What did you ask me for, then?
Because you're supposed to be a friend.
You asked me what I thought about your router, and I told you, it is horrible.
How is it? Is it? Yours isn't exactly a gem of architectural beauty, is it? Look at it throbbing away there.
Any more observations from you in that particular strain, and I shall fetch you a right punch up the bracket. This, mate, has got character. It has never been insulted before.
And that reminds me of his nose being described as a throbber in The Smugglers. Look at it, you know.
Yeah.
Up
yeah,
one side, yeah, down the other, in, out, throbbing away there. Oh. Brilliant
it's
all, stuff.
Yeah, it's on, off, on, off.
Your nose is throbbing. Your nose always throbs when you're worried. All the blood drains from your face and goes into your nose. I've noticed it.
I'm all right, I tell you. Leave me alone.
Makes the rest of your face look so white.
I'm all right.
There it goes. It's throbbing again. Look at it. Bang, bang, bang. Look at it going there.
Will you stop staring at me?
What are you twitching for?
I'm not twitching.
You are. You are. Bill, he's twitching. Isn't he twitching? Look, look. Look at the corner of his mouth. There it goes. Look, it's alternating with his nose. There you are. See? Nose up. Lift up. Lip down. Nose on. Nose off. Lip up. Lip down. Nose on. Look at them both together. Tilt.
But interestingly, the script actually uses the word rotten nose rather than the brilliant hideous hooter.
Hideous hooter.
So that that must have been a last minute change, I guess.
It's quite odd that Sid's not facilitated to sort of rip him off a little bit.
He's the one with the nose anyway, isn't he? I mean,
yeah,
his facial
it's got character.
Features,
it's
you
got
know.
Character, Tim.
But it's quite interesting that there's no Sid's the villain almost. Come on, Hancock, I'll sort out your nose for you. Give me 100 guineas and I'll sort it out for you. And he sort of tries to help him, really, doesn't he?
It doesn't so much happen in the TV series, though,
does
it?
It's a different role.
Yeah.
It's a very different sort of,
One thing I like is when Sid first comes in and Annabelle Lee has been given the boot, he says, "How do you get on?" And Hancock says, "I didn't."
Where is she? Where's the bird?
She's gone.
How'd you get on?
I didn't.
You told me you were home and dry.
And so I was.
Well, what happened then?
I don't wish to talk about it.
I didn't.
Yeah. There's another scene where Hancock goes to smash the mirror and it doesn't break. We have talked about that. What he hits the mirror with something, doesn't it?
It looks like it's a fluff, but he throws a vase at it. And it looks like it's a fluff, but it is scripted. It's meant to bounce off.
Is it really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
I read
right.
This earlier. It's meant to bounce off, and he's meant to give a look of disgust at himself and the fact that he can't do it, and then pound the mirror. So that is all scripted.
Right.
The look is not quite disgust. It looks like he's trying to stifle a laugh, because he is.
I thought it was a fluff.
Yeah.
Well,
the
feeling I got, certainly with the second one, I think it bounced rather well.
Too well, perhaps.
And it flew off, didn't it? And
Too well.
I think that's probably what the laugh was, that it wasn't supposed to pounce off at speed. I mean, I think he had to duck to miss a second one.
Fly in the direction of the audience or something, you know.
But I was surprised by that because I thought, oh, the mirror's supposed to break and he's laughing because he didn't.
Yeah.
But no, that is actually in the script. And the other thing that I don't know if you noticed about his living room, did you notice the clock?
Nope.
The clock says 5 to 12, whether he's got the lady there. or when he comes in the room to say, oh, I can't look at my nose yet, it's 5 to 12.
Well spotted.
Then the clock strikes. The clock strikes 12, and guess what? It still says
5 to 12.
Still says 5 to 12 right the way through.
Well, creamy 5 to 12 in this episode, then, yeah.
Yeah, time stands very still. But I guess if you were watching the episode on a fairly small television screen, as you would have been in the 1950s, you probably wouldn't have noticed.
No, no. Unless you had one of these magnifying glasses in front of the telly.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I doubt they thought that in 60 years' time, four blokes be analysing it over a computer.
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed.
I suppose like a stage play, you've got the dressing, it doesn't have to be a working clock, and in fact, the ticking might get picked up by the mics and be distracting, perhaps. I don't know. Yeah.
Quite probably. So, and then I love the, going back to Barbara Archer, I love her description of Tony's ears at the end.
Flap about like a cab door.
Stick out like jug handles, flap about like cab doors.
Yeah.
Handsome rogue of a fella.
What's the matter with you?
Oh, sorry, but I can't help it.
What's the matter with me nose?
Nothing. I think you've got a lovely nose. Why?
Well, what are you laughing at then?
It's your ears. Flap about like cab doors.
Hello, Dr. Worthington. Yes, it seems to be me ears. Like jug handles, she says, yes. Flap about like cab doors, yes. Yes, I'll be round.
And again, that's different from the script.
Is it? Oh, is it?
Because the script says, haven't you got Barbara says, haven't you got funny ears? Don't they stick out? Flabby too, aren't they? And of course, the final version that was used was much funnier.
Yeah.
Oh, I think so. Flap about like cab doors is a much more eloquent way of putting it.
Yeah.
Right.
Must have come out in rehearsal.
It's a brilliant way of putting it. That was that must have been a last minute script change.
See, there's only one actual fluff I noticed in this. It's only very slight fluff that John Le Mesurier gives when he's talking to Sid about it. Explaining, you know, when he can take the bandages off. And he just, slight fluff, he says the wrong word and then corrects himself. So there's nothing major that's an entertaining fluff in this one. No moments.
The operation's been a complete success. I'm very pleased with it.
Oh, that's marvellous. When's he coming home?
Well, it's up to him, really, but he can take the bandages off in a couple of days.
And I quite like the moment with John Lemez. We'll try that one on. It's that sort of Groucho Marx comedy glasses with the moustache and the spectacles and the plastic nose kind of thing that we all had one of those as kids, so we can all relate to that. And that's a wonderful image as well, isn't it? Tony's like, oh, never mind, I might use it in my stage act, you know.
Stage act. Put it to one side. Put it to one side.
Yeah.
Just try that one, will you?
Yes, certainly.
I do beg your pardon. I don't know how that got there. We keep that one for office parties.
Oh, never mind. Just put it on one side. I can use it in my stage act.
One of the things when we do these podcasts is, of course, go through the cultural references and stuff. And when I was watching this, I thought, actually, I'm not sure there are any in this one.
I couldn't think of any.
And it made me think that it's the radio episodes where you have the cultural references and not in the TV episodes, unless the whole episode is one cultural reference, because plastic surgery was in the news at the time, particularly with the rich and famous.
Okay.
And I did a bit of checking, and people like Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe had nose jobs done. But in those days, they didn't make a play of it like people do today. And the fact that they had this surgery only come out many years later. But I just wonder whether in the press at the time there were stories about showbiz stars, perhaps unnamed, you know, having this sort of surgery, and the fact that it was available, and that might have been what Gordon Simpson to write it.
You think people like Liberace, he was always big on the plastic surgery as well, and he did the weird thing with getting his lover to have plastic surgery so that his lover looked more like him and could pretend to be his son in public events, something very confusing like that. So, but that was a bit later in the 70s, 80s, oh. I think, or 70s, presumably. Oh. I remember seeing the film with Michael Douglas. Very good. Anyway, you know, Liberace would be an example of someone who probably had a few nips and tucks and, you know, you didn't have your Botox then, but you did have various things where they'd stretch you out a little bit, I'm sure, to make you look young and beautiful.
Mm. I mean, I think plastic surgery had been around for many years, but I think you're right, Tim. I think it was coming into its own in the 1950s. Yeah. I guess, you know, we never had it so good and it was a more affluent society in general. So I know there's a huge number of exceptions to that, but I think that's probably, as you say, it's a whole cultural reference in itself, the actual episode.
Yeah. But it's interesting you don't get the other cultural references, isn't it? You know, I mean, I guess they didn't need to pad out the script so much as they did in the radio episodes, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah. You get a few to different actors and things like that that we've mentioned they refer to in terms of their nostril capability. Yeah. There's a wonderful line where he says, you know, oh, to see that when he's had that done, oh, you shouldn't play with things beyond our ken. Which gets a laugh.
Yes.
I'm frightened. I'm scared, Sid. It's not natural what I've done. Playing with the unknown, it doesn't seem right.
Of course it's right. You're not the first one.
Suppose it's a failure. Suppose it's worse than the other one. I shouldn't have done it. You can't tamper with nature. Vanity, that's what it was. One of the seven deadly sins, vanity. Can't mess about with things beyond our ken.
And Beyond Our Ken had started the previous July in 1958 on the radio.
Yeah.
So that is a reference and a joke about the TV series, I expect. The radio series, I expect.
But it was an expression in any case, wasn't it?
It was an expression anyway. It gets the laugh because of the radio series.
Yeah.
And the,
yeah.
Like in The Missing Hancocks, there's a line in one of the episodes where Kevin says, "Winter's coming," and the audience laughs because it's a well-known line from Game of Thrones, of course.
Winter is coming. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that would have been the time that was very, very hyped up.
Well, you'd have known that, John. I wouldn't have known that.
I only watched the first series now. I got very bored with it. But I know the line because everyone was obsessed with it back in 2018 or whatever it was. You don't get so many references. I mean, I suppose as well, sort of plastic surgery and all of that, you think of the Guinea Pig Club and people like Jim with the tash. What's his name? Jimmy Edwards.
Jimmy Edwards.
Jimmy Edwards of Take It From Here and Fame and the Glums and things like that.
And Wacko.
His moustache was to hide scarring following an accident during the war when he was in the RAF. So the advances of technology in the 40s meant that by the time the 50s came around, people could have custom nose jobs and things like that rather than it just be to fix a disfigurement in wartime. So, yeah, sort of that whole era was a whole revolutionary era, the 50s, when you think about it, just as much as the 60s or the 70s or the 80s were later.
Mm.
Yes, there are so many developments in all the decades, really, aren't there? We always think of now and think of the pace of change, but, of course, there was a fairly significant pace of change in the 50s, culturally as well.
Yeah.
The country emerging from war and moving into, you know, your supermarkets and your burger bars and your coffee shops. It was a complete change of culture, really, from what had gone before. And it's great because we can experience it through the radio and the television episodes of Hancock. It's a real sort of window onto that time, which I just think is amazing.
Well, when you sit and think about the shows and analyse some of the things that are said, you know, You can pick up a lot of those sort of things just by dint of us doing this podcast. I think I know far, far more about 50s culture than I did before I started doing them, just because you're given that opportunity to sort of mull it over a little bit, aren't you? And it's can throw up some interesting bits and pieces.
I've always said, if you want to know what life is like in the 50s, listen to Hancock's Half Hour or watch it or whatever. It just sums up the 50s, doesn't it? In the same way that Dad's Army sums up the 40s.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Can I just mention one other line we haven't mentioned? It's just the way he says it, and it just makes me laugh, and that's Roger Avon's character when he's got the new nose and he's showing it off to Hancock. Or is it Sid or Hancock? Anyway, he's saying, and he says,
Sid,
divorced my wife, got a new one.
I'm a new man. I divorced my wife, got a new one.
Plastic surgery, of course. That's what Hancock needs. Do you know that he hasn't been out of the house for 2 weeks?
Because some stupid bird told him he had a funny ooter?
Well, has he?
Oh, it's the same as anybody else's. There's thousands of ooters like his.
Yeah, Bagsby, Tom, has divorced me. I've got a new one. It's a brilliant one. Yeah. It's just such a simple line.
It's like saying, I traded in the car, got a new one, you know. I divorced my wife, got a new one.
Got a new one.
Yeah. Went down the wife's supermarket.
Beautifully done by him, isn't it? It gets quite the laugh from the audience. It strikes me as one that really stands out. So if I must have missed that from my scribbled notes, I'm glad you mentioned it, Tim. Roger only appeared in this one episode, I think, of Hancock's Half Hour. But he was in so many things, and he was a really, really talented performer. Never a big star, you know, one of those sort of just regular character actors that appeared in all sorts of things, in all sorts of roles.
Well, when you look back over Hancock's Half Hour TV series, I mean, the quality of the supporting cast is one of the things that makes it as good as it is, isn't it? You know, people like that. You know, we I don't think we've mentioned him before in our podcast, although we've mentioned the various other people who probably crop up more often than Roger did. Well, some of them are fairly regular. But, you know, the supporting cast in general were fantastic. Very, very good actors.
Well, good old Duncan Wood was good at choosing them. And he was also... Roger was in 7 episodes of Citizen James, the semi-sequel to Hancock's Half Hour without Hancock.
Oh, we'll see. Okay. Well, yeah. Right.
And 3 episodes of Sykes. He was in stuff with Frankie Howard. He was in 3 Hancock's Half Hours. The other 2 only exist in audio, which was The Beauty Contest and The Wrong Man. I imagine he must have been one of the criminals in the lineup or a policeman in The Wrong Man, because he played a lot of policemen over the years. But yeah, he's such a distinctive looking actor as well. Hugh and I is another thing he was in. Just lots of stuff.
That's a great series.
Another name we haven't mentioned so far tonight is Ivor Raymond, who was the guy with Alec Bregonzi talking about the clown.
What's it?
Well, that's what it says in Wilmot, unless he got it wrong again.
Fantastic, isn't it? Like a great red tennis ball on the end of his face. Yes.
he lives around here, I understand.
Does he really?
Yes, I've never met him, though.
I can't help laughing every time I think of his nose.
Well, Ivor was in the episode. It just says various characters on the IMDb. I think you're right. I think it might have been Ivor. I hadn't noticed that because he's not doing that voice that he does in all these speaking parts.
I was just going to do that. Dad, I got the sack again.
I got the sack today. They kicked us out of flat as well.
I got the sack today.
Yes.
Yes. I think they're chucking us out the flat and all.
Are they?
Yes.
Yeah. Ivor was so good,
a great musical arranger who worked with Dusty Springfield and all sorts of others. This was just a bit part of his, you know, side hustle, I suppose, being a part actor. He also did some work on the musical arrangement for Hancock's Half Hour, I think.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't realised that was the same guy as the dad character.
Now the son
character.
Or the character that says, the son character that says, Dad, I've lost my job. I won't try and do the accent.
Look, not moving back in here.
Yes. On that note, I suppose, I guess it's probably time for the scores. So, what do you think you're going to give that one, Martin?
Well, when I started to listen to this, I was thinking I would probably give it, you know, a 7-ish or something like that, because it's not one of my go-to episodes. I normally go for the television. I'd normally go for the sort of 5th or 6th series. Always, I think there's a lot more classics in that. But having watched it for the preparation for this, same as for so many episodes, you sort of get to know it so much better. And you hear and see things that you otherwise have missed in the past. So I think it's a brilliant episode. It's a lovely idea. And the fact that Ray and Alan took advantage of the fact that this was being recorded so they could do something fantastic with the makeup and have this new nose. The great supporting cast, and as you say, the characters really, I think, really come to life in this from the supporting cast. John LeMessurier is absolutely exceptional as the Doctor. So I've upped my score to an 8 for this one. I think it's really good, and it would probably become one of my go-to episodes in the future, particularly if I'm watching the unedited version. I have to say, that's one of the reasons possibly why it wasn't one of my go-to ones, because I know it's edited and I'd rather watch one that's not been edited. So, but no, loved it. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
So when I saw this one coming up on the list some time ago, I listened to it quite a lot before I watched it. And I wasn't that excited about the episode. However, I think once you've listened to it a lot and then you watch it, it does reignite something. And I think if I could go back in time, well, I might be wasting the power at this stage, but if I was able to pop back in time, I think I'd love to go back and watch this be recorded. And I'd also love to watch them rehearse, because I could imagine the laughs that they must have with such a quite a wide supporting cast. The makeup, trying to put the nose on Tony, I think it would be hilarious to watch. And I do feel there's a really good energy to this whole episode. I think John LeMessurier is absolutely, he's a consummate professional anyway, but he's superb in this, and as are all of the other performances. I think Sid's great. I think Sid's got it goes slightly off away from Sid's character in that, you know, the villain who always is trying to con out. It feels like he's really trying to help Hancock in this one, which goes against the grain a little bit. Similar to Martin, I probably would have scored it a 7 if it was just a generic episode listening to this, but I too have upped my score to 8 because I just think it's great. It's a great watch. It's a really good watch. And I don't generally watch the TV programmes. It's something I'm usually listening to when I'm working or when I'm driving somewhere, or, you know, even when I'm drifting off sometimes, it's something I'm always listening to rather than watching. I've got the DVDs, but I will watch them, obviously, occasionally, but it's not something, oh, I'll watch a DVD. I'll listen to it while I'm doing something. So, yeah, 8 for me. But a solid 8.
Nice. Solid 8.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, you see, I think with this one, I see what you mean, James. I mean, I think it probably doesn't work quite as well on audio because you haven't got the reveal of that prop nose at the end, of course, which probably only really works very well in a visual terms, because from the soundtrack, he look beautiful. You don't know for a few seconds till you know, other people react to it. But I think, you know, with these shows, I used to watch these as a kid or old VHS when I was off sick from school back in the 1990s. And I think this one really does stand out as a fast-paced show, as Martin said, because of the fact that it was recorded. You know, you've got several different sort of sets and scenes and locations, and it chops between them quite quickly, which you notice with these shows onwards, that they were able to do that a little bit more than they had been previously, where you'd have a long, ponderous 30-second segment between action while things got prepared and actors ran around the back of the set. So I think particularly Annabelle Lee's hysterical performance at the beginning, giggling away, really works. And I really like that moment of him trying to do the wooing and her just cracking up and just being, you know, bit of a silly girl type character. That's not quite right, is it? But a naive and sort of giggly character who likes a bit of cider to get her going. And Roger Avon is great as Arthur Dilwater. He's got such a distinctive look, and you can imagine Roger with a much larger nose. So I think they cast him quite well in that, because he's got a big face and a small nose. I think I'd give this one probably an 8.5, I think, a strong 8.5, because it is a fun episode. It really works well, both in the edited version and the unedited version, although obviously having more, 1.5 minutes more of it is preferable, as it adds a little bit of extra context at the beginning ending of scenes. I do have a sort of fondness. I remember some of those 80s repeats that they had, the sort of the blue backgrounds in the title sequence at the end and stuff, and looked a little bit more 80s, I suppose, you know, for that. This one's great fun. It really ramps along at a great pace, and they all put their all into it. the moments of pathos as well as comedy really work, and they're on top form. So 8.5 from me.
I think I agree with most of what's being said. I think it certainly does go along at a decent pace. It's quite good for a television episode. I think the script is actually sparkly. Like Martin, it's not one of my go-to episodes, but as has happened time and again when we do this podcast and we watch or listen to the episode several times before sitting down in front of the microphone, and you really get to get into it and to get into the detail of it and sort out what you like and what you don't like. And it is a very good episode, there's no doubt about it. Hancock himself is on absolutely top form in this episode. And as has been said, the supporting cast as well. Like John, I particularly like Roger Avon. I think he plays the nose man brilliantly. I think Mario is superb in his little role as the milkman. I think that is, yeah. He does that very well indeed. The two girls, Annabelle Lee and Barbara Archer, who Hancock is trying to get romantically entwined with, both come over wonderfully. Particularly Annabelle Lee. I do like Annabelle, and I think she plays that line with the cider brilliantly. Absolutely wonderful. I think it's a terrific episode. I don't think it's the best of Hancock's half hour, but it's certainly up in the top group, as it were. But I'm quite happy to give it a solid 8 out of 10.
I'd say that's an average of 8 points, which is certainly more than an armful. So that's about it for this week. If you'd like to take it away, Tim.
Why not join us in the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society today? You can find us at tonyhancock.org.uk for all the information on how to join.
For just £13 a year, you'll have access to the members area of our website and receive 4 magazines a year by email packed with information on Tony, his shows and archive material.
Members also get a digital-only bonus pages supplement every quarter.
Or you can have full-colour printed copies of The Missing Page posted to your door for just £16 a year in the UK or £26 worldwide.
And we're a friendly and welcoming bunch, so please do join. We have reunion events, including a special centenary event in May, guest speakers and special screenings.
Please do get in touch. We love questions, conundrums and feedback. And to do so is very easy. Just send your emails to podcast@tonyhancock.org.uk.
Keep an eye on our social media accounts for all the latest news and all things... Oh, not... Blah, blah, blah. Start again.
Blah, blah.
Keep an eye on our... Keep an eye on our... Keep an eye on our social...
Well, we got to keep an eye on, Tim.
Have a run at it, Tim.
Keep an eye on our social media accounts for all the news and all things Hancock. Our Twitter or X accounts are East Team Lad, Tony Hancock Appreciation Society, and Very Nearly an Armful. Or you can find us on Facebook.
Our next episode will be our first ever live podcast from the Riverside Studios Hammersmith, following a screening of The Colourised Blood Donor, where we're going to make lots of mistakes, especially to keep the audience entertained.
Indeed. For now, that's Very Nearly an Armful, so I'll say ta-ta.
It's sayonara from me.
Chickadee snitch. And this is GLK London closing down for a quick cough and a drag.
Remember, Tim, you meant not to destroy everything with a pretty nose in the house and cover all the mirrors with drapes and things. Just because of your horrible hooter.
You leave my horrible hooter out of it.
Has he got a pattern book in front of him that he's looking at?
This has been an official podcast of the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. Unfortunately, it was not written by Alan Simpson and Ray Gordon, whoever they are. The announcer was me, Robin Sebastian, currently appearing in the saloon bar of the Hendon Racket.
He was an Elvis Presley.
Yeah. A Jimmy Durante with a Serrano de Bergerac on the end of it.
Bergerac on the end.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Another good one, Ronnie.
Another good one, Ronnie.
Another good May, Ronnie.